84%. Wind is from the west at 12. The new numbers are in. 76 degrees this morning in Racine. It is 77 in Kenosha. 73 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. 76 in Milwaukee. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. We are talking today on the morning show about pain, a reality in all of our lives to a varying degree, but some people live with quite severe pain and or chronic pain, pain as a constant and most unwelcome companion in their lives. And much has been written about the phenomenon of chronic pain and also about the concurrent addiction to painkillers, which in many respects can cause equal or even greater misery to the person in question. A very interesting book about these important topics has just been published by Da Capo Lifelong Books. It's called The Pain Antidote, the proven program to help you stop suffering from chronic pain, avoid addiction to painkillers, and reclaim your life. One of the authors of the book, Dr. Mel Pohl, is a licensed family practitioner specializing in the treatment of chronic pain and co-occurring addiction at the Las Vegas Recovery Center. He has written previous books on the topic, including A Day Without Pain, Pain Recovery, and Pain Recovery for Families. This latest book, again, is called The Pain Antidote. And Dr. Mel Pohl, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to be here.
I'm so glad to be able to talk with you and for us to have this conversation about such an important topic which touches so many people's lives. Has this been your specialty all along? I mean, throughout your career? I know you've been doing this for many, many years. I mean, even when you were back in medical school, was this already the focus of your interest and energies?
In actual fact, it was not. I am trained in addictions. That's my my specialty. I'm a family practitioner, and because I have expertise in addiction medicine, so many people who come to be treated for addictions also presented with chronic pain that about 10 years ago, I decided that it was kind of puny to say, go back to your pain doctor once I've got you detoxed from these very potent drugs, and got real interested in what I could do with the team at Las Vegas Recovery Center to really impact the lives of people who had both chronic pain and who had become dependent on drugs, and that's where my interest has grown over the last 10 years, and it's very fascinating work, I can say that.
So your interest began on the addiction end, and at some point Correct. You started to become a little more interested in the pain, which sometimes triggered addiction to painkillers.
That's exactly right. Mm.
One of the really interesting points made in your book that is, on the one hand, relatively obvious, and yet I think really is worth talking about, is the fact that pain is something so very personal and also, in a sense, inward. At one point you write, your experience of pain is personal and unique. Your pain is what you say it is. And I think what you're talking about there is the fact that unlike certain situations like, yep, that's a broken leg, or yep, that's measles. There is, in a sense, no outward scale by which one can detect and even prove the presence of pain in a person. And I should think that right off the bat is one of the things that makes it such a difficult situation to deal with. I mean, for the person suffering from pain and the person trying to give them help, the fact that we're talking about something that, for as real as it is also by its very nature frustratingly intangible.
Well said. I mean, it really, pain is an individualized experience. It's universal, so everybody has experienced pain in his or her life over the course of our lives, usually multiple times. But my pain is not the same as your pain. It happens in my brain, and my brain is influenced by billions of nerve cells interacting with trillions of connections. All of my past experiences, my cultural training, my educational background, my mood at the time, how much I ate that day, and all of that contributes in the moment to my own experience of pain. And you know, I can't tell a patient that he or she doesn't have the pain that they tell me. And often that's the beginning of that misunderstanding that we talk about in the pain antidote, where people really aren't believed by their physician and by their families and by their employers. And it really ends up being very diminishing to the patient.
Hmm. I know this is not the primary focus of your energy, but I suspect that as someone who deals with people dealing with pain, that you, at least from time to time, probably come across people for whom their pain is, in a sense, only real in a mental way. That is, they are perceiving themselves to be in pain, which in a way means that they're not in pain. But there are certain disorders in which pain is really more than anything imagined. I suspect that's a very rare phenomenon. How often do you encounter it?
Actually, that's the center of our work, and it's the center of what we really have attempted to characterize in the book. So let's sort of take this step by step. Let's say I have back pain, which I do. I have a bulging disc in my back. It's chronic. It's been there for longer than I want to think about, but 15, 20 years without any great injury. But I've had an MRI, and people have poked me and stuck me with needles and burned my nerves and offered me surgery, which I promptly said no thank you. But my experience of pain is influenced by my mood at the time and by a whole lot of emotional experiences, particularly anxiety, fear, and anger. And that's really characteristic of people with chronic pain. Going further, people get depressed when they're in pain. People feel diminished, that they're not, you know, fully themselves. They have lowered self-esteem and ability to function. All of those things make up the sum total of a person's pain experience. And I would, you know, sort of challenge, and I do challenge my patients and families and other doctors, why is that any less real than the bulging of the disc on my nerve? And the fact is, it is no less real. I can define for you, if we had 3 hours, the neurophysiology of this process, so that there are parts of our brain that light up when we are in chronic pain, and those parts of our brain are really more associated with emotions than they are with the physiology of what's happening in a person's spine or crushed foot or headache, for example.
I guess that really explains the truth behind the heading in section one, the section which is called Understanding, when you say all pain is real, and trying to help us understand that all pain must be taken seriously, both by the person suffering it and by those entrusted with treating them.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And there's, again, this tendency to misunderstand and mischaracterize that if somebody doesn't have evidence of pain, that they are making it up. And there are people who are malingerers, but even people who are seriously addicted to drugs, they're not making up the pain. They have a spiritual sickness, if you will, that drives them to want painkillers. Mm-hmm. And so it's they are suffering with the overall process of pain, and they convey that in whatever way they can. And, of course, for those folks, the goal is to get medication or drugs. And, you know, that's a whole other set of problems, but it is, again, not any less real in my experience and opinion than somebody with a broken leg.
Right. I think what prompted my question was thinking about a phenomenon that I know very little about, a disorder. I think it's called Munchausen's syndrome, or Munchausen's by proxy, in which there too, I'm sure you would say that we're talking about some kind of a pain, but in that case, it's a pain which an emotional pain or need which drives people to actually inflict harm either upon themselves or upon somebody else for the sake of receiving treatment and care.
A much more complicated diagnosis, actually, than the kind I see, thankfully. I've never treated somebody with Munchausen syndrome knowingly, but the psychopathology, if you will, of somebody with Munchausen's is different than the vast majority of the millions of people. 100 million people have pain in the United States. So the vast majority of people with chronic pain have started with either an injury or some sort of traumatic event, and they've now developed this patterning of emotion and thought and physicality that drives this experience of chronic pain, so that, you know, the typical experiences that I feel, you know, speaking as Mel, I feel pain in my low back. That's where it's coming from. But I know, at least conceptually, that where that pain exists is in my brain.
Hmm. More so than in your back.
Correct. And it's a hard sell. Let me tell you, I have a woman who has a very unusual case of what's called Charcot foot. Basically, the bones in her foot just deteriorated, and she's got major problems in that foot. And we have this conversation about every 3 or 4 days. What do you mean the pain is in my head? It's not in my head. It's in my foot. Look, there it is
right
there.
Well, and I'm sure one of the reasons it's difficult to get people to embrace that notion is because it might sound to them as though you're saying just the opposite of what you're saying. What you're saying is you are imagining this pain. This pain isn't real. And what you want to say, your message of your book, is that all pain is real, even that pain which, in a sense, is more mentally or emotionally based than physically based.
Yes. I'm chuckling because I had a patient who I went through this explanation, and I taught, that's what I do day in and day out at the center. And the conversation was just as we've described it, and her pain was chronic headaches. And she just got red in the face, and she said, you know, you're crazy. You telling me my pain is in my head? And I said, well, you have headaches, you know, so where else do you think it is? So, you know, the implication that if emotions are driving this pain experience, that it makes it somehow less valid and less legitimate. And there's a whole literature in the medical profession that says, and here's the sort of corollary with the opioid epidemic, if you have legitimate pain, you can't get addicted. That's what the drug companies told us 20, 30 years ago, and that's why we're in the midst of this horrible drug epidemic. So it implies that there's legitimate pain, and then there's this other thing that is somehow worthy of discounting and making less significant. And you know, our point throughout the book and throughout my work is, no, that's just the same as real. I mean, I could show you a picture of the brain and look at it on a functional MRI scan and show you that part of the brain lights up, but it is the same part of the brain, the limbic system, where we feel those emotions.
We're speaking with Dr. Mel Pohl and talking about a book which he has just published, co-authored, called The Pain Antidote, the proven program to help you stop suffering from chronic pain, avoid addiction to painkillers, and reclaim your life. I appreciate the fact that you quote the work of many others in the field, and also quote a book which I remember purchasing and reading with great interest a number of years ago, a book co-authored by Philip Yancey called The Gift of Pain. And I don't remember the co-author's name now, but it is a doctor who...
Dr. Brand.
Yes, Dr. Brand, yeah. Who worked with people suffering from leprosy. And it was really through that work that he came to a profound understanding of the purpose of pain, that pain, in fact, serves a life-giving purpose, a function in which pain is meant to protect us. And I suppose, in a sense, you're talking about, in the realm of chronic pain, when pain ceases to serve that function, in a sense, and begins to hinder our lives and create more heartache than protect us. Talk about that transformation that line, wherever it is, where pain is no longer our friend and is more of an enemy.
You know, first I have to say that when I talk about the necessity of pain, that the utility of pain, patients with chronic pain get kind of ornery about it, because after all, who wants their pain? You know, it's not really true that that I need this foot pain or this back pain or these headaches. And it really bears differentiating between acute pain, which is I've broken my leg and I better know that it's broken or else I'm going to walk on it and injure it worse, which is what happens with people with leprosy. And they end up having an amputation of that leg because they've damaged it beyond repair. Versus chronic pain, which is pain that lasts more than 6 months, which occurs in either a tissue damage, so, you know, a disc in my back, or in conditions like chronic headaches or fibromyalgia or a very unusual condition called complex regional pain syndrome. So now we're talking about the brain disease of chronic pain, which is totally maladaptive. In other words, I don't need my back pain. It doesn't tell me anything of value. I can walk for miles. I can hike. I can climb. I can stand on my head. I can go scuba diving. I can lift weights. All of those functions are intact. However, it just hurts, darn it. You know. So it becomes that source of frustration and consternation, which is not what pain was originally purposed in our nervous system. So that's the tricky part, is we're really talking about a different entity. When we talk about chronic pain, which is that's the work that I'm referencing, we're talking about something that has nothing to do with acute pain except the word pain.
It actually, as I started reading your book, it made me wonder how much you might secretly wish for us to conjure up some different terms, since the term pain is used to talk about so many different things, and in a sense that makes it even trickier then when somebody walks into a doctor's office talking about pain. Well, what are they talking about? They could really be talking about a lot of different things.
Yeah, and that is part of the challenge. You know, how much pain are you in on a scale of 1 to 10? Well, you know, a lot of my patients say 15. Which is absurd. You can't have 15 out of 10. So what people are trying to convey is it's really, really bad today, but 10 is the worst pain you've ever had, ready to pass out and become unconscious. And most people who describe a 10 pain aren't judging it in an objective way by that scale. Then try and locate it. Well, you know, if you have fibromyalgia, it's all over the body. It's a sense of aching and throbbing and a real diminution of well-being. So a sense of being sick and tired and weak. And those things are really big parts of the overall experience of pain, but hard to characterize. And then, you know, people don't come into the doctor typically and talk about, I'm really depressed. I haven't slept in 2 days. I'm frustrated that I can't work. I feel angry at my family because they don't understand. And that's, you know, that is part of the essence of chronic pain. And it's at the center, you know, that's what we spend most of the day looking and focusing on, that. And, you know, a lot of patients don't want to do that. So, you know, I understand when people pick up the book, sometimes they don't get a warm, fuzzy feeling from the message that, gee, this is bigger than I'm really looking at. But I can tell you from the work that I've done and from the neurophysiological studies, 80% of the overall experience of chronic pain is based in the emotions and thoughts that we have about the pain. And I would call that suffering, you know, and of course I didn't make that term up. That was, you know, part of Buddhist literature over 2,500 years ago.
Right.
But it really is the human being's response to the physiological process that's happening in his or her body that really is the challenge of treating chronic pain.
Right. That being said, I'm just curious, when somebody comes to the Las Vegas Recovery Center complaining of pain, does your initial examination with them delve very much into the physical? I mean, like if they say, yes, my legs hurt terribly, are you about the business then of, well, let's get on this table, now move your leg this way, now move it that way, oh, that hurts more than that moves? I mean, are you involved in that sort of physical aspect of it to a significant extent, or is your specialization more about, in a sense, the matter of living with that pain and what is that doing to a person mentally and emotionally?
Right. I am a family doc, so the first evaluation that happens here at our center, at least, it consists of a good physical examination and some basic laboratory studies, and often a review of very copious records. I mean, you know, people come with boxes of records about all the tests that they've done and all the diagnoses they've had. So we try and compile and not repeat most of the studies. I mean, it's very rare that we'll order an MRI unless something has really changed. But we're very interested in the physiology of the condition, and we move from that. And let me say, if there's something I can do for the physiological condition, you know, let's say somebody has a chronically sprained ankle, we'll do ice, and we have a variety of devices like a TENS unit, and the physical therapist will work specifically on that area to strengthen and to stretch. So all of those measures are a big part of the interventions, and we spend a lot of time in the book talking about the need to be physical, and that's about 25% of the overall picture. The other 75% ranges in the emotions, the thoughts, and we spend a lot of time talking about spirituality, which is, just to clarify, that's not associating it necessarily with any religious beliefs or even in a belief of a deity, but rather something other than me. You know, the focus for people with chronic pain is so often my pain, my life, my tragedy. And one of the therapeutic interventions is to move people away from that self-focus to, you know, you're part of the universe, the world that needs to get functioning again.
Hmm. Another section of this opening section of your book, again, called Understanding What Chronic Pain Is and Isn't, is when you talk about the brain, and you talk about the brain in a way that I think may really catch some people by surprise. I think it kind of surprised me as well, this notion that chronic pain changes the brain. And I think most of us think of it only in the other direction, that if I'm feeling this chronic pain that maybe does not have a completely physical cause, well, then there's something wrong in my brain. Something's misfiring up there that's causing me to feel this pain that really isn't there or isn't as bad as I think it is or whatever. But but we think of it in that direction. And your book, among other things, sets out the possibility of chronic pain, in fact, affecting the brain and its function.
Yeah.
Explain that.
Our brain is, the term is plastic, so that's means it's capable of changing in response to whatever stimulates it. So a simple example is if you study, you learn things. Well, the way you learn things is that cells communicate in a particular pattern, and if you've learned it and then you reinforce it, that pattern will be established, and we can actually show that the cells are talking to each other more effectively in that particular area of the brain. Well, similarly, if there's a signal, you know, let's go back to my back. You know, I have a nerve that's entrapped by this bulging disc in my lumbar area. It's firing. It fires all day, every day, day after day. And that continuation of firing symbolizes to my brain that something is going on that's significant. I've just told you it's not. I mean, I know from my life experience that it's not, but my brain can't differentiate that. So what happens is the brain truly becomes sensitized to these signals, and it establishes a pattern within my brain substance of cells communicating one with the other, indicating that something significant is happening in Mel's back. As a result of that, over time, it's the process is in the physiology world is called wind up. So I picture that as a spring that's being wound tighter and tighter and tighter, and the more tightly it's held, the more discomfort I feel, and that is happening in the limbic system part of the brain. Let's back up to, let's say you get a nail in your finger. The instant you get the nail in your finger, you will have a series of things that happen. You will feel the ouch, but you'll also feel annoyed with yourself for having been careless, and you'll recall a memory that the last time that happened, you got infected and you have to go to the doctor, and you won't be able to do your work because you'll be distressed. All that happens momentarily when we feel pain because of the stimulation of the limbic system associated with pain. The benefit of that is that we do something about it. You know, we have a negative response and we rise to the occasion. With chronic pain, that system of alert is co-opted. So picture an alarm clock that you're able to turn off when you waken being acute pain, and picture an alarm clock that just keeps buzzing because the circuitry has now been taken over and it's just a self-fulfilling buzz, 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 buzz all day, every day, and it doesn't have any function whatsoever. That's analogous to what's happening in the software of the brain. So it's not the hardware, but rather it's the software programming of the signal in the brain that is misinterpreted as significant when it's not.
I imagine that this is relatively new data that you and others in the community are processing and trying to decide what to do with.
Right. I'll say that if you read the Buddhist literature, which is very on point with this stuff, they knew this a long time ago. The Buddha said, you know, when you shoot a man with an arrow, it's like shooting him with another one, and they feel the pain of two arrows. So really the description is I have the pain signal and then I respond. Now, they didn't understand physiologically what's happening probably until the advent of functional MRIs. And in the last 5 years, we've seen studies that really define what I'm talking about so that we can prove and attach some data to what we're saying. But we actually have a machine where we can cause pain and look at the pain on a scan and show that people with chronic pain have a different part of their brain light up than people who have acute pain.
In the very next section of the book, you explore some of the ways in which our emotions drive our pain, exacerbate our pain. And first of all, how closely tied is this to what you were just describing in terms of the effect of chronic pain on the brain itself in a tangible, measurable fashion? Is that in turn then what leads to this other matter of emotions having a direct effect upon pain? Or is that an interaction that's in a sense happening on a different level or in a different way?
Nope, it's happening right where we've been talking about. So we now have this circuit. Picture sort of a reverberating closed circuit, and it's just going around. It's just going around, going around, going around, going around, and the experience is pain. And then I get stressed. I get somebody's at my door, and I'm pressured to go to the next thing that I have to do. And I'm worried about what I'm going to do tonight, and I didn't sleep well, so I'm not feeling rested. All of those sort of triggering events cause that reverberating circuit to speed up or to intensify. So really what we're talking about is not necessarily, but possibly that emotions are at the root of the chronic pain, but also that in people who have this circuit, when they are anxious and fearful and angry and depressed and frustrated, their pain level will go up. And that's all defined in brain circuitry.
In the final section of a final part of section one, understanding all of this, you begin to explore actually what it is that first brought you into this field, namely the treatment of addiction and specifically co-occurring addiction, that is when chronic pain leads someone into the unhappy state of addiction to painkillers. Among the really interesting things you talk about in this portion of the book is the distinction between dependence and addiction, being dependent on painkillers versus being addicted to them. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you would share a little bit about that distinction. Is it okay to be dependent on painkillers in a way that it is not okay to be addicted to painkillers?
Right. Well, yeah, it's a complex question. We had a real struggle in that chapter because so many people feel like they're addicted because they take their pills every day and they can't stop. That really defines dependence. Dependence means my body is used to the drug. It doesn't do well without it. And that is characteristic of most people who take these painkillers, these opioid narcotic painkillers. Tolerance is the other part of that phenomenon, which means the drug doesn't work unless I use more. But those characteristics of dependence are components of addiction. And what we see sometimes is people who have a flavor of addiction. That is, they're drawn to the drug for reasons other than pain relief, or they're drawn to the emotional relieving effects of the drug, or some people actually wake up when they take the drugs and they feel energized, or I'm preoccupied, you know, I'm going to run out and I have to get to the doctor. Life starts to revolve around the medication, not because people want to get high, but because they want to maintain that consistent supply of what they perceive as relief. And the definition of addiction that we quote in the book is when we pathologically pursue relief, we really are on the in the realm of the disease of addiction. And again, this is complicated, and the whole chapter is devoted to that that distinction. But it's really interesting because so many people that I see in treatment don't have, you know, they're not chewing their OxyContins and they're not using dealers, and they, you know, no sooner do heroin than they would stand on their head for 10 days. But they are drawn to the drug, their life revolves around it, and that may not be addiction, but it's certainly not a healthy approach to using a medication for a symptom.
As it just so happens, by interesting coincidence, earlier this morning I recorded an interview with two documentarians whose film that's soon to air on PBS is not about anything you and I are specifically talking about, but about the phenomenon of internet addiction and the way that it's being very aggressively treated in the nation of China, where it's an especially acute situation. And of course, it's a different thing. But on the other hand, again and again in this film, you hear these young adolescent boys protesting over and over again, I could quit playing if I want to. I could quit playing if I wanted to. And that rhetoric of denial, that makes internet addiction sure seem a lot like the other kinds of addiction that we hear a lot more about. And I should think, going back to our very first point, the fact that because pain itself is such a personal, unique experience for each person, it also, in a sense, enables a person, if they so choose, to really engage in that whole business of self-denial. I mean, because you get to write the narrative when we're talking about pain. And in a sense, it's very easy to write the narrative about addiction to painkillers. And I suppose you, as someone providing treatment, you need to help try to intervene so that narrative is, in a sense, rewritten and resemble the truth.
The truth. You know, the denial, which is what we're describing, it stands for don't even know I'm lying. So,
wow.
That to look at the intentionality as part of the process is often is not accurate. Think about people who really believe that everything is okay. Now, they believe that because they need to believe that because they are compulsively using and they can't picture life without. Bringing it back to people with chronic pain, most of my patients who come here are so perturbed about giving up the opioids, even though they get that the opioids are not doing them very much good, and their fear is, what's life going to be like without it? And that's characteristic of any addiction. So, you know, if you looked at the brains of people with internet addiction, they're quite similar to people with opiate addiction and cocaine addiction and heroin addiction.
We're speaking with Dr. Mel Poole, and we're talking about his book, The Pain Antidote, the proven program to help you stop suffering from chronic pain, avoid addiction to painkillers, and reclaim your life. Well, even as our time dwindles away, we certainly need to touch on the fact that your book, two-thirds of your book, steps beyond the reality of pain to the reality of overcoming that pain, living with it well, and perhaps even moving beyond it in some really exciting ways. One of the things that you talk about in terms of that process of overcoming one's chronic pain, learning to live with it in a more healthy fashion, is this matter of achieving more realistic expectations. What are the expectations that people have going into this process that might exacerbate the problem? Why is it important for expectations to be more realistic?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I have a patient that I'm working with right now who is 59 years old, and he's got rotator cuff disease in both shoulders and cervical spine disease, and he injured his foot, and we had a conversation. He's not in treatment with me right now, about him using painkillers, and he was playing basketball. Now, it's great that he wants to be active and play basketball, but a 59-year-old person with the kinds of life challenges that he has really would be better served by going for a walk than playing basketball. So, you know, what does that mean? You have to give up things you like? Absolutely not. You have to find things that you like that within reason will not diminish and cause an increased likelihood of injury. Because injury, of course, is really what drives some people to continue to take their painkillers. So we spend a lot of time, and we have a staff that really is quite expert with people talking about pacing. And pacing is a science that's really known well to physical therapists and other rehabilitation folks. It's really, you know, not going back to the level that is likely to cause injury, but finding things that are meaningful and worthwhile in your life, and then working towards them in a very graduated fashion. So, you know, it's not come to treatment on a walker and power walk the next day. It's come to treatment on a walker and then use a cane and then take a short walk around the facility and then go outside and walk the track. And, you know, by 4 weeks later, you may well be power walking, but at a reasonable pace. And Right. Those are really, they're skills that are tough for folks to embrace.
Right. And of course, another reality that you talk about in the book is that even as one seeks to, I think you put it at one point, restore one's physical balance and the presence of physical activity in one's life, if you've really been debilitated for a while, the reality is that often that initial effort of exercise might even yield a little extra pain in the short term. Yeah. And some of that might be well worth it for the long-term benefit that is awaiting you on the other side.
Yeah, no pain, no gain is really very real. And we work with people on a principle called hurt versus harm. So I don't want people playing basketball and spraining their ankle, but I do want people walking. And I want them moving more today than they did yesterday and moving more tomorrow than they did today. So that progression, and we talk very gently in the book. I mean, if you've been bedbound and you want to try and get up, take a slow walk to the bathroom and back, and then go to the mailbox, and then go halfway up the block and make sure you know that you have to get back. You know, those are the kinds of interventions. But and you know, my patients come back from physical therapy and they say, my pain score is up, but it's good pain because I know I'm tightening up my core muscles, and that's what I need to do to strengthen my back.
We need to talk about a very strong warning that is given in your book when it comes to the matter of medication and the fact that when one is on painkillers and perhaps addicted to them, and one feels the need to step away from them, that it's so important that that is done carefully, cautiously, that just an abrupt discontinuation of medication can perhaps create more trouble than it helps alleviate. First of all, physically, what is the problem if somebody is foolish enough to just cut off all their pain medications just like that? Physically, what happens in the body that could cause harm?
Well, we're talking about dependence now, physical dependence. So we're talking about people who've taken a medication or series of medications on a regular basis. Those people's bodies are sort of joined to the drug in a dependent way. And stopping the drug suddenly will cause, at the least, discomfort and nausea and vomiting and diarrhea, and more dangerously can cause seizures and can cause a severe withdrawal syndrome that can even be life-threatening. So because of the physical nature of the combination of the drugs and the person's body, it's absolutely imperative that they either be slowly weaned or responded to by a skilled clinician who knows how to do what we call detoxification.
In our last few minutes, I want to give you an opportunity to sketch at least the kind of general parameters of what you bill as the 4-week jumpstart plan, which is a means by which someone who maybe has lived with chronic pain for such a long time that they never even imagined life without it can actually perhaps, in a sense, trip themselves into a much more positive reality by making some important changes in their lives. What are we talking about?
Well, first I want to acknowledge Kathy Ketchum, who's my co-author, and this is her invention, let's say. But what we really realized was people come to Las Vegas Recovery Center for at least 5 weeks, and some stay for 90 days or more in an inpatient setting with a team of clinicians that are dedicated to doing this work. We're offering sort of a home-style version, and we just became aware that there was so much that people needed to think about beginning to do that we wanted to give them an opportunity to get started, and that's what the 4-week jumpstart plan is. And we break it into 4 weeks and look at 7 different areas, certainly diet and nutrition. And it starts with simple things like water and maybe vitamin supplements and looking at proper foods that are damaging and foods that are beneficial. Exercise is key, again, starting with gentle stretching and walking. Sleep has to be mediated, and often when people are on medications, their sleep is disturbed. When they come off medications, their sleep is disturbed even more. We go through a series of acupoints, which is self-acupuncture, if you will, a well-worn, tried and true technique to decrease pain in various areas. We teach people about breathing, and there's a series of breathing exercises that are based in meditative practice. To deal with thoughts and emotions, we teach people how to reflect and journal, and we give them topics to look at. And then the last is, if you are moved, try. And those are things like massage and yoga and qigong and acupuncture, all of which can be accessed either through the internet or through a CD, or of course if you're able to access a class with a skilled practitioner, all the better. But again, the Jumpstart plan is really about taking some chunks out of all areas, but little chunks, and then building on those benefits and moving towards a better life.
And your book, we should mention, also includes some recipes designed to help fortify one's diet, so you're making sure to take in foods that, generally speaking, have a positive impact upon something like chronic pain.
Yes, and we spend time talking about what foods should be eliminated as well that might be pain-inducing.
Here's the last question. Here in Wisconsin, I think a lot of us happen to be more aware of this notion of addiction to painkillers because of one Brett Favre, former quarterback of the Green Bay Packers, who I think very courageously and very forthrightly, as was his style with just about everything, was completely public, completely open when he realized he was addicted to painkillers and needed help. And I suspect that his public stance on this topic, while surely an intensely difficult situation for him, has helped a lot of people just by bringing it out in the open. How much difference have you seen in the years that you have been working in the field of pain in terms of our openness to it, our interest in the topic, and our willingness to wrestle with this reality more openly than was once the case?
You know, I'd love to say that we've made leaps and bounds progress, but the truth of the matter is we have so far to go. There are so many people who are dependent on drugs. There are so many physicians that really don't understand the overall impact of prescribing opioids long term. And there's such a sort of a cultural resistance to really allowing people to recover within their limitations. So I think everybody who comes out and self-identifies is of tremendous value. There's just an uncountable value. But there's still 40,000 deaths. 17,000 deaths a year. 40 people die every hour from an opioid overdose. More than motor vehicle accidents in the last couple of years. So, you know, we really have an epidemic crisis, and it's going to take a concerted effort from government and physician groups and pharmacy monitoring programs to push back against the very intense impact of the pharmaceutical industry that wants to sell these medications to the public. And you know, it's going to take some consciousness raising. The fact is, life is not pain-free, and an attempt to be pain-free with painkillers really backfires more than it is helpful.
Mm. Well, your book is certainly a big step in the right direction in helping all of us to have a better understanding of all of this. The book, again, is called The Pain Antidote, the proven program to help you stop suffering from chronic pain, avoid addiction to painkillers, and reclaim your life. The book is a paperback from Dacapo Lifelong Books. Dr. Mel Pohl, thank you so much, first of all, for the work that you do on behalf of so many people in pain. And thank you for writing this interesting book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we are approaching 8:58 on this very warm Friday, July 17th. WGTD HD is what you're listening to. We appreciate it. We'll be joining Wisconsin Public Radio at 9 o'clock for their classical music programming. But between now and then, we can get you updated on the weather forecast for the rest of today. Partly sunny, very hot and humid, slight chance of rain. Look at this. We're heading for a high today of 95. The heat index approaching 101 degrees. Perspective on those numbers, normal high this time of year would be 80. The record high was 100 degrees. We set that just a few years ago, July 17th, 2012. Tonight it stays a warm and muggy. Overnight low 69, but the heat index overnight remaining high at 97 degrees. Another one on Saturday, another burner, partly sunny, very hot, 30% chance of rain tomorrow. Tomorrow's high should hit 93 degrees inland, 88 degrees near Lake Michigan. The heat index on Saturday, 106 degrees. A little bit of relief comes our way on Sunday, partly sunny, very warm, again a 30% chance of rain. Sunday's high, 83. Looks like a good week next week, sunny, 82 on Monday and Tuesday, 79 on Wednesday, and then 83 on Thursday. Here are the current stats. Humidity 84%. Wind is out of the west at 12. Sunshine, a blue sky. already 78 degrees for Kenosha and Racine, 75 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, and 76 degrees in Milwaukee. Once again, classical music programming comes your way next here on WGTD-HD. It comes from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio.